Good science in there, Rich. With your ohmmeter, with your voltmeter, you'll eventually find out who's creating the open circuit. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet. Just gotta be careful about the... maybe you gotta wear gloves when you're doing this work, if you know what I mean.
No, I don't think so, Dick. I'm used to working on transmitters with fixed 800 volts. Just tell me, how does it come off? Does the top come off in one part?
I'm pretty sure, Rich, every brand name is different. You're going to have to put it on the desk, turn it sideways, upside down, whatever, and look for all of the screws and rivets and everything else. Every case is different, so you'd like the answer to be they all, the outer plastic cabinet, once you loosen up the screws, just lifts vertically. You'd like to have that as an answer. Maybe it's true, I don't know. Tell us what brand name it is, and maybe somebody owns that brand name. N2EO, K2LIW.
This what you said your wife has. It's a very simple Mr. Coffee.
Yeah, we didn't have a Mr. Coffee. I don't remember what brand it was, but it was brand X. It was very inexpensively made. So, in my particular case, I don't think I had to remove the whole case. I think I only had to remove the bottom cover. And I could see what was going on, if you know what I mean. So, you put it on your table and turn it over. I'm pretty sure you're going to see what's required to open it up, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW.
2KNH.
Mr. KNH, maybe you own a Mr. Coffee, and maybe you've already climbed inside. Start off with your name, sir. Mr. KNH, K2LIW.
This is Charlie, KD2KNH. I was monitoring the TechNet. There's about 100 different YouTube videos, very detailed, on how to fix Mr. Coffee. So if Rich just monitors, goes on YouTube, they cover just about every aspect, how to disassemble and repair and troubleshoot.
Darn good information, Charlie. Boy, that internet's got everything. Mr. Tim Berners-Lee, I think he invented the internet somewhere around 1989. Isn't that amazing? 28 years ago? Look what that has turned into in 28 years. Anything you want to know is there, even if you're afraid to ask. N2EO, K2IW.
Okay, Dick, and thank you, Charlie. Me and Charlie speak on a regular basis. So that's good input. I'm going to look tomorrow. It didn't seem to me like the heating coil would work one day and then not the next. So I will look. From what you're saying, Dick, you jumped it out.
Yes, I did. Which is half as bad as putting a penny behind the fuse. You put a penny behind the fuse, your house has absolutely no protection, and you could burn down the house. In the case of jumping out the thermal protection extra switch that was in the coffee maker my wife owned, I know that there's a chance I'm going to turn on the heating element at the wrong time when there's not enough water there and it's going to overheat and it's going to burn itself up. And as long as we are keeping the coffee maker in the place on the counter where there's nothing nearby that can burn, as long as she keeps an eye on it, I gave her plenty of warning that, hey, this thing is on its last legs. Make sure you're watching it when you're using it. As long as you're willing to use those protection techniques, I'm willing to jump it out. So know that you're taking a risk when you do that. You've got to keep an eye on it, Rich. N2EO, for any other information, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Very good. Well, thank you. And you might want to know, I have mentioned it many times, I'm looking very forward to it. I'm moving up to the Monticello area. And Bobby knows a lot about that area. He's helping me as well as a realtor I have. And he's going to help me sell my house and move up there. And the reason I'm bringing it up, I don't want to buy another coffee maker down here. When I get up there, I'll buy everything I need. Back to that. I'm with me. M2EO.
Okay, good luck with that move, Rich. I know you're going to be talking back to us by way of Echo Link. If that happens to be if you're out of range with your rooftop antenna, talk to your buddies on LiveLock. Okay, one quick call to both Freddie, KB2VBN, and Andy, N2HUH. Is either Freddie or Andy available? K2RAW in the TechNet.
N2HUH.
Go right ahead, Andy. We gave you a call earlier, and you got called away. And if you fell asleep at the switch, that's okay, too. You got it, Andy.
Alrighty-o, Dick. Well, as you know, the weather's not been too good for the past couple of months, in my opinion, and I couldn't resist to do some amateur astronomy tonight. In my opinion, the skies are at least average, but I say they're above average in transparency and seeing. So, Rich had brought up a subject about water heaters, so I was going to ask a question. Let me let it drop. Actually, I was in the middle of comparing two binoscopes. But anyway, to water heaters, without going into too much detail, I'd like to know if you or if anybody else knows, is there a gas-fired hot water heater, 40 gallons, that does not have any sensors, electronics, or any other kind of nonsense that I don't need or want? I can't seem to find a regular mechanical analog hot water heater. The one I have now is needed repair twice with this HydroSense electronic circuitry, and I was successfully able to repair it, but I want to buy another one, and hopefully it doesn't have any of that electronic nonsense on it. I find it useless and quite annoying, and so if anybody knows of any mechanical gas-fired water heaters that are still available, N2HUH.
KD2HUC with a comment.
Go ahead, Steve.
Really, he shouldn't have that much trouble trying to find them at all. I know Home Depot carries them. I like to get mine off of, there's a website called supplyhouse.com. It used to be located in Farmingdale. They just recently moved to Jersey. But what he's looking for, if you really want no bells and whistles, you got to get away from the high efficiency. Once you start looking at high efficiency units, they put blowers, they put electronics to monitor combustion and all that other stuff. Most people, including myself, if I had gas, want the bare bones, mechanical gas valve, no electricity required, because during a power outage, you still have hot water. So they're readily available, like I said, Lowe's, Home Depot, as long as you know what to ask for. You don't want to ask for a high-efficiency unit. You want to ask for just your regular $300, 40-gallon natural gas water heater, and it shouldn't be a problem. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, let me ask you a question on this one, Steve. He's already got probably a good water tank, and maybe the heating element is something he can buy separately. Is that possible, or does he have to replace the whole darn unit? KD2HUC, K2RIW.
I would say he probably has to change the whole thing because the shape of the combustion chamber and whatnot. For the high efficiency units with forced draft and whatnot, they're designed differently than those which are, just natural convection, so to speak. And they're relatively inexpensive, Dick. You're looking at like $300-$400. You know what I mean? And they're not. You go for these high efficiency units with the electronics, like he's talking about. You're looking at $1,000, $1,200. And I happen to agree with him. I wouldn't install one with all the bells and whistles. It's just something more to break. And I think everybody knows how the wife reacts when there's no hot water. KD2HUC, back to net.
Thank you, Steve. In the case of my hot water heater, which is oil fired, there's multiple brands of oil burning assembly that I could put in there. But in the case of electric, I can see how it's a lot more complicated. The failure that you had on your hot water heater electronics before Andy. What was the failure? What did you have to do to fix it? And what makes you think you're not going to be able to do it again? N2HUH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I do thank Steve for agreeing with me, but however, I don't think we're on the same page because there's no fan involved, there's no electric involved, there's no batteries involved, there's no power source involved. This is all from the thermocouple. And this is called a hydrosense unit, and it's very low current electronics. There's a flashing LED, there's sensors, more than one sensor, different things. And don't want to bore anybody, I do know what all the sensors are for, but the point is, the unit that I looked at in Home Depot, it was $400 or $450, and it had the same exact electronic unit on it that mine had, that I don't want. Let me let it drop and see if I can answer your question, Dick.
Yeah, you got to tell me what failed and what you had to do to fix it. Wait for the beeps.
Well, there's a sensor on it for water level. There's a sensor on it for another water level sensor. Then there's another sensor for the pilot light. Make sure the pilot light is lit. There's a sensor for it'll come to me. My mind is on astronomy right now, but. I think there's a sensor for something else, but it's not just coming to mind. And there's a series of flashes on the LED that'll tell you what sensor is bad or what the problem is. And I've never seen this before. It's ridiculous. And everything from cleaning the contacts. Let me let it drop again. Cleaning the connectors, cleaning the contacts on everything, on the sensors. I was about to start soldering the wires onto the sensors, but then I had to tighten the spade lugs, clean them, tighten them. You name it, all that nonsense, and Molex connectors, vacuuming. I had to vacuum clean the system. That affected it on and on and on, one thing after the other. And this is what they're selling now, is a hot water, basic $400 hot water heater. It's unbelievable. And I want one that's all mechanical with no flashing LEDs, no electronics. And I can't seem to find one, N2HUH. 82HUC
with an answer.
Okay, we're going to go to Steve and Eric in that order. Go ahead, Steve.
If this is what this is the only thing they're offering at Home Depot, I would try supplyhouse.com. If they all have this, fancy nonsense on it, then I would go to Johnstone Supply and see if you can just get a replacement valve, a mechanical valve with a standard thermocouple, and then you should be able to keep the tank that you have and just, get rid of all the sensors and all the nonsense. You will be going back to a regular thermocouple. I don't know, people have had them in their houses for 50 years. When they break, you replace them. You get them anyway. It's not a big deal. But if this is the only thing they're offering, try the other place, and then you might have to go and see if you can get a mechanical valve from Johnstone Supply. Give them the model of the water heater, and they might have something that matches up. KD2HUC, back to net.
Comment.
Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, yes, thank you, Steve. Thank you very much for that. That's what I'll try if I can't find a local at Sears or Home Depot what I want. I do want to say that a few years ago, I had recommended it here, right here in the Limelight, that the putting a mechanical a thermostat on a hot water heater that failed. And that's exactly what I did a few years ago to my water heater. However, then eventually that water heater that I was repairing was over 10 years old, and eventually the tank went somewhere in between years 12 and 15. So I bought another one, And now, after 2 or 3 years, the warranty, a day after the warranty expired, this is funny, the day after the warranty expired, I called up to try to get a part, like the HydroSense unit or a couple of sensors or whatever the hell I wanted, and they told me that I'm a day late. It's out of warranty for parts. I couldn't believe it. So now this is where this is where I'm at. I got a good water heater with a good tank, and all it needs is no electronics. So I might have to actually buy a mechanical thermostat and see if I can retrofit it into HUH.
Eric, I think you had some suggestions. KE2EJ, KE2RLAW, go ahead.
Well, it wasn't really a suggestion. It was just being thankful that I have an indirect water heater. Didn't have to go to any of them. But you might try Blackman's and another place. Blackman's all over the place. They can get you just about everything. It's a very nice use all the time. You know, with indirect water heater, the thing that heats the house also does the hot water in it. Surprisingly efficient, and the tank itself is nothing more than a heat. The ceramics in that is warranted to be RWP, because yeah.
Yeah, Blackman has a lot of parts like we're talking about. There's a Blackman on Railroad Avenue in Huntington, or is it Long Island Avenue, but on the street that goes parallel to the railroad in Huntington, there's a Blackman. Another place that'll sell you parts is Sid Harvey. And both...
Harvey's not that big on gas components.
Yeah, they've got the oil-fired things, but you're saying not much on gas. I'm sorry to hear that, Eric. Go ahead.
That's some, but they're not big on it. I had a number of years back. I mean, if you want anything for an oil-fired burner, yeah, they got it. If they don't got it, they'll make it. But 2 years back, we were looking at found in Blackwood, and they just have... They have some generic stuff. They might be able to help them out, but I just never found them to be big on gas appliances.
Somebody's going to make a comment. I'll get you in a second. My guess is there's a website that we can go to Blackman. Hopefully there's a website where we can go to Sid Harvey and we can look up parts like this. If the person wants to make a comment, go right ahead, give me a call, letters, and name. K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, Roger, Dick. It's KC1SAM. Sam up in Connecticut. You might try some suppliers out of Philadelphia or Lancaster, Pennsylvania. The Amish probably use something like that. I know they use gas refrigerators, so it makes a sense there might be some gas requiring gas water heaters also. Back to you.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion, Sam. By way of internet, you can find that place, and maybe the part can be shipped to you by mail. That's probably what you're suggesting. You're probably not suggesting he drive all the way to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. What do you think, Sam? K1SAM, K2LAW.
Yeah, I think UPS should be a lot cheaper. But, yeah, the internet would probably, I don't know any suppliers on it, obviously, but the internet would probably point you towards a couple, maybe a phone call or two also, and he might just find what he wants.
Yeah, so they have no electricity, and they would have to have something that's purely mechanical. You said there was no electricity. I'm a little bit confused by that one, Andy, because to turn on that current for that coil, it's got to be a big contactor. I'm having trouble believing that contactor moves by thermal. There's got to be a battery somewhere pulling in a solenoid to move that contactor, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. And by the way, if it is a thermally operated contactor, I see a problem. An electronically operated contactor, it slams home and slams open. A thermally operated one is going to slowly close as it heats up, which means it's arcing and sparking all the way. Which means that those contacts have to be cleaned, because anything that slowly closes is slowly going to be eating up those contacts. N2HUH, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy.
Well, just as you said, Dick, that's why I don't want it. I don't want this junk. I don't want it. The manual doesn't mention anything like a 10-year battery or anything like that, so... They're claiming that it's low current from the thermocouple, and there's a flashing LED. So you go look up HydroSense, HYDROSENSE, and And you can read what I read, I guess, and I didn't see anything about any other power source, so this is exactly why I don't want it. It's ridiculous. And even your questionnaire epitomizes why I don't want it. It's ridiculous. I'd rather slap in a new mechanical thermostat. However, if I'm going to buy a new unit, I shouldn't have to go out and buy a $150 mechanical unit and take out the new one and put in, you know what I'm saying. So it's ridiculous to have to buy a new unit and have to go through all that.
Is the whole hot water heater with 40-gallon tank, roughly how many dollars is that? Andy, go ahead.
I'm not sure if you're talking about the one I have or the units that are being sold now. I think they were A.O. Smith's brand, and they all had this electronic device on them. That I could see on the $400 40-gallon hot water heater, gas fired.
Yeah, that's the information I'm looking for. And I think I've got a 40-gallon tank on mine. I think the price was in that vicinity. A center flue oil-fired hot water heater. And in my case, as you guys know from what you've heard me say in the past, I put an insulated coupling on the cold water input pipe and the hot water output pipe. My hot water heater tank totally floats, and I put insulated washers where the burner attaches to it, because the burner is grounded. So when I floated that, all of the tank being eaten up by galvanic action and the pinholes I used to get in my copper water pipes, all of that went away. There's all kinds of galvanic action going on. And mine is 15 years old. I looked at that sacrificial rod a couple of years ago, and it was brand new, untouched, pristine. So I have reason to believe my hot water heater is going to last some ridiculous number of years now that I've isolated it. And if I wanted to be thoroughly safe, I should put a great big grounding reed between the two pipes, the cold water input pipe and the hot water output pipe. They used to have a completed circuit by way of the tank, and now they're floating. However, I've got cold water coming off a Y going to all the faucets in the house, and all the faucets in the house are touching the hot water pipe. So I think my system is grounded, but if I wanted to be double darn sure, I should put a grounding lead across those two pipes. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call. That is right now, K2LIW in the TechCast. Okay, so today we're into hot water heaters, oil burners, a little bit of astronomy. Time we go to the space report. Paul Cassini had a very successful mission for 13 years right at Saturn. The latest issue of Scientific American has an article by Carolyn Porco. She was the engineer in charge of the optical devices on board. And so the latest issue, which I think is the August or the September issue, wait a minute, September or October, the issue that arrived yesterday, I think it was, or could very well be the October issue of Scientific American. It was about a four-page article by Carolyn Porco with some nice pictures and explanations of what all took place at Saturn. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, now we only have Juno orbiting the outer planet. You know, Mars, we have plenty of orbiters there. One thing in orbit around Jupiter called Juno. No more Cassini. That went, took a dive into orbited into the atmosphere at 70,000 miles an hour. And it burnt up the little atoms. So that's gone after orbiting 2004 and launched in 1997. And some of the people worked on it years before that, so some people spent almost 30 years involved in Cassini. So maybe they'll get involved with something else if they're young enough. Maybe the Wilson Clipper. Now, you know, the report I saw about Cassini said that these people are going to have data that came in from that destructive burn, all the last little information that came back. And they'll be looking at that for the next 5 years, 5 to 10 years. So I guess the science part of it is not done. That will keep on going. The engineering part is finished. So I'm looking forward to another flight out there. They need to get something on the books for Saturn again. I'd like to see spacecraft go to Enceladus, you know, the plumes that are coming off of that planet that Cassini discovered. I'd like to see something go in there with better detectors. Don't forget all the detectors were created in the 1990s. We put on a 1997 spacecraft. Originally, that was going to be launched on a space shuttle, but after Challenger, they changed their mind and they decided to put it on an expendable rocket. And it was the Titan 4C. Dick, I was going to talk about a couple of things. We don't have that much this week. Let me drop it. But there was a hurricane, of course, Hurricane Harvey. And, you know, you brought up the fact about James Webb Space Telescope down at Johnson Space Center that's being chilled, tested in the big room. Massive door, and they put the whole spacecraft in there on tracks, rolled it in there, and they're doing all kinds of testing the mirrors, the alignment of the mirrors, laser beams, bringing the temperature down to, I think it was around 40 degrees or so Kelvin, minus 377 degrees Fahrenheit, and it turns out they had planned for a hurricane when they put this piece of equipment together years ago. So they knew if there was a hurricane, this thing would keep on going and open all kinds of backup generators and fuel. So they never lost a beat. They had a picture of the people that were working on it. It looked like about 30 or 40 people. They took a picture of them. And they stayed there. They slept up in the building, didn't go home, and everything worked out good for the James Webb Space Telescope, which will be launched September, I think, of next year. And that's another spacecraft that's been worked on for the last, 10 or 12 years. I think it's $8.8 billion now, that's projected cost. So that's going to go out to the L2 position, 1 million miles away from Earth. 4 times the distance away from the moon, and sit it there. It'll be able to do its astronomy from that location. So looking forward to that launch from a Ariane 5 rocket. That's by the European Space Agency. That's their contribution. Part of the $8.8 billion is involved with that. Look forward to them doing that next year. Now that hurricane came through Houston, the other one, Irma, came through Florida and did not do too much damage to Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral. That hurricane stayed on the western side, but they still have very strong winds there. And one of the, it swore maybe a piece of roof walk here and there, nothing to get, wound up about. But with the wind, it knocked over something called the moon tree. They have a moon tree.
Repeater, timeout.
They have something called a moon tree in the visiting center, or just outside. And it's been there, since 1976, since the bicentennial. They planted it there, and it didn't survive. So now these things roll over to all over the country, different types of trees. And what happened was during one of the Apollo flights, took 500 different seeds and left it in orbit around around the moon and then brought it back, and they wanted to see if there was any kind of difference between the radiation and the microgravity. They would affect these seeds. So when they brought it back, they opened it up, fouled up things. When they opened it up, they all got mixed together, but turns out every seed was good that they planted, and they wound up with these moon trees all over the place. And one place was in Florida. Let me drop it. They had a control, by getting science, they had a control, and the controls were identical seeds that didn't go to the moon, and they would plant sometimes a moon tree next to another tree. So this way they were able to show that, well, at least during this couple of week flight to the moon, that there was no difference. They said after 10, 20 years, you look at these trees, you just can't tell the difference between the control and the experiment. So, but it was a shame that they lost their tree that went to the visitor center. Now, there are a second generation of these things. They took the seeds from the trees that grew, and they, in turn, you know, I've made little saplings out of that and planted them in different places as well. So that was pretty interesting. Let me drop it. Not many flights going up. A couple of foreign flights and different things happening. But there was a flight, two nights ago. It was actually early morning here, like 1:30 or something in the morning, from California, from Vandenberg Air Force Base. They launched their NROL, the National Reconnaissance Office launch number 42. They launch stuff all the time, by satellites, really, is what it is. That's what the National Reconnaissance Office does. So it was launched successfully. After one day delay, they had to scrub because there was a bad battery on board. So they had to scrub for 24 hours. But it got off successfully on an Atlas V, and it's a 541 configuration, which means it had a big satellite on board to have a 5-meter diameter fairing on top of that rocket with the satellite enclosed, and then it ran with four solid booster rockets. So, you know, you wind up with a fine thrust of roughly 2.5 million pounds, and they didn't put it into a polar orbit. I guess they're not interested too much in the what's going on in the Arctic, but they did put it up at 63 degrees inclination. So that's pretty much it. Let me drop it. And then the Chinese, they've had a couple of launches, but what was interesting with them is they ran one more test. They have a space station up there. Tiangong 2. They've already had Tiangong 1, number 2. And they sent the equivalent of, let's say, a Progress spacecraft up to test to see if they could refuel, dock, refuel, undock, separate for 6 months or so, and then redock again, refuel, and then undock. And they destroyed the spacecraft over the Pacific Ocean a couple of days ago. It turns out everything was successful. This gives them the go-ahead for the bigger space station that's planned. And they're going to have five different modules going up, attached in different ways. And they plan on actually sending the first one up, I think, in 2020 or so is their first launch. And then they'll start sending more up. Dock them together, and during all this time they'll be sending people up, and their goal is to eventually have a permanent group of two or three people on board. So we're not the only ones interested in space stations, that's for sure. That's pretty much it, Dick. Turn it back to you. K2RIW, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
So I'm glad to hear that in Houston, they had a standby crew and generators and fuel and everything else to make sure that the vacuum chamber with its cooling, probably took a lot of kilowatts of cooling to keep that chamber down at 43 Kelvin or whatever it was. That's a very cold cryogenic temperature. Above helium, helium boils off at 4 degrees Kelvin, 4 Kelvin. Liquid nitrogen boils off at something like 75 Kelvin. The 43 is halfway between the two. It's a lot colder than liquid nitrogen, so it requires some pretty serious refrigeration. And if you read the articles, they were producing a wall of liquid around the James Webb Space Telescope while it was being tested, so that when any of those mirrors looked out at the chamber, they're not seeing the chamber wall, they're seeing this cold inner wall that they had erected in there. And I think there's liquid nitrogen on one side of the wall and a refrigeration fluid on the other side, on the nearer side to the James Webb Telescope that was being tested. Let me drop. Now, one of the articles I've read in the last week about James Webb tells me that it's got, I think, 18 individual mirrors. Each one has got a very specific shape to, when you put them all together, they act like one great big mirror with just the right shape in all locations. So you've got these 18 mirrors made out of this very light material. Was it boron? I'm not quite sure what the material is, but a very light material. And it's beryllium. Beryllium. And gold-coated, because gold surface reflects the infrared very well. Now, each one of those mirrors has seven separate motors attached to the perimeter and one in the center, I think. Seven motors, six motors around the perimeter at the six points, maybe, and another one, plus some other kind of a fancy mechanism with a whole bunch of rods going to a motor behind each individual mirror. So therefore, they can tilt each mirror in azimuth and elevation. They can adjust the shape of each one of the mirrors. So when you go into space at some other crazy temperature after all the shake, rattle, and roll of launching this thing, let me drop. And maybe with the aging of the materials, I called it boron, but what's the name of the material again, Paul?
Beryllium. Very, very strong. Stronger than steel. And the shrinkage coefficient on it is like, you know, zero. It won't change at all at those low temperatures.
So these beryllium mirrors, which they hope are extremely stable, very light, hold their shape just right under cold temperatures. But now you've got these six or seven motors, seven or eight motors, around the perimeter and one in the center, where you can not only tilt the motor, tilt the mirror, but adjust the shape of the mirror. If the mirror becomes a little bit too concave or convex, the motors allow you to adjust that. So having all of these motors, let's assume that it's seven motors on 18 panels. That's a lot of individual motors. I hope they all continue to work well. The next question is, how do you know when each one is tuned right? The answer is you aim a laser beam at each individual corner, any little place you want to on that mirror. You aim a laser beam and measure time of flight. And I think that measuring apparatus can tell, you know, to the nearest micro-inch or sub-micro-inch, probably nano-inches, where that portion of the mirror is located and compare it to where it's supposed to be and adjust the motor accordingly. However, in the case of the Green Bank Telescope, which was, it's 100 meters in diameter, 300 some odd feet in diameter, the telescope, made out of something like 2,000 individual panels. And in order to tune those panels, they've got a laser retroreflector in the corners of each panel. You aim a laser beam at the corner reflector and measure time of flight. And therefore, you can tilt all those panels. Let me drop. So my next question would be, is there a laser reflector, a corner reflector, in each of the six corners of each one of these panels? And the answer is no. Okay, how do you get away with that? Because each one of the panels has a very specific shape, where angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, so it's made for reflecting a signal, an optical signal, an infrared signal, in a very specific direction for each little square centimeter of that mirror. So in theory, you'd need a whole bunch of photo reflectors all over the place. It'd be peppered with them. I suddenly realized that's not required. A mirror obeys angle of incident equals angle of reflection. It's got a very sharp reflection beam from that mirror. If and only if you've lit up a certain percentage of the mirror. Let me drop. If the dot coming out of the laser hitting the mirror is small enough in diameter, that little piece of mirror will reflect a signal isotropically. If the dot is small enough, there is no antenna pattern. The angle of incidence equals angle of reflection doesn't work if you're lighting up a piece of the mirror that's, let me pick a number, a half a wavelength wide. If it's only half a wavelength at optical frequencies, at the infrared frequency, you'll get a reflection beam coming out of there that's 80 degrees wide. So, therefore, where you aim this very sharply pointed, very sharply focused laser pointer at any portion of the mirror you want to measure, you can measure the distance to that portion of the mirror. So they've got ways of aligning each of the 18 panels. They can align the shape of the main subreflector, the secondary subreflector. That whole Don system with that laser pointer system can be aligned as if there were corner reflectors in all of those areas, and you don't need it as long as the laser pointer is sharp enough. I wonder if they could have done that on the very large telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, which is a radio telescope. I think the same technique would have worked there. But that modern technique didn't necessarily need all those corner reflectors. I wonder if what I just said that makes some sense, Paul. WS2N, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, but I don't know if they did it exactly like that, though. They had a laser beam, and they sent it essentially through a prism of some sort, you know, they divide the light depending on the timing of when the laser is coming back at all the different points on the, all over this big 21-foot diameter mirror. Depending on when that came back, and it, you know, it's got to match the other laser beam, and they adjust the motors to, they said, 1/10,000th of the diameter of human hair. So I had to read that twice because that sounds unbelievable. And I went to another website to confirm that. That's what they said. So they're using some kind of interferometry in the system. Is that what you read? And then if that's different than what you're saying, then it changes everything.
What I think you're describing, Paul, is the time of flight, which measures the distance very accurately, is done as an interferometer. If you measure time of flight, every foot is a nanosecond, every inch is a 10 picosecond, and they want to get 1/10,000th of the thickness of a human hair, we're down to sub-nanometers here. And can you measure the timing of a sub-nanometer as a time delay of the laser beam going out and coming back? I think the answer is no. However, if the laser is operating at some nice frequency, like 540 nanometers, green, in the middle of the optical band, and if you've made an interferometer out of it, now, in other words, you split the beam with a beam splitter, one of the beams goes through a 45-degree partially silvered mirror and goes out to the object being tested and reflects back. The other goes to some standard distance device and reflects back. And now, where the two beams come together, tune for a null. And the null can allow you to get an extremely small fraction of a wavelength, of the wavelength of the laser light. That gives you probably 10,000 to 1 greater resolution of range as an interferometer. The LIGO, the gravity sensing machine with those 4 kilometer long tubes. Let me drop. That signal is reflecting back and forth across that 4 kilometer pair of mirrors at each end some large number of times. I'm going to pick a number, 400 times. And then it goes into an interferometer and you tune for the null. So that signal you heard with that gravity wave was the difference between the reference path and the non-reference path going in and out of a perfect null. And that's what made the signal that you heard out of the gravity detector. So that is, I am guessing they're using an interferometer to measure the individual positions of that 21-foot diameter mirror, measuring, for all we know, Paul, they're making a 10 or 20 measurements across each individual panel with an interferometer system. Does that seem to make some sense? Some of that's guesses on my part. WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, I've read a couple of articles on how they do it, but they weren't any more precise than that. It sounds about right. They have the two beams. They did see that. And one beam is going straight directly into they call it the tertiary mirror, the third mirror. That in turn goes to the detector. So the detector is in that one path, the one beam, and then the other one that's going off hitting the mirror and then bouncing back, coming back, has to come back at the exact same time. And if it doesn't, these motors come on and adjust the mirrors. I read six motors to each mirror. You read seven, so there might be something that's close enough. But yeah, you're right, they could adjust mirrors in all these different locations. And also the mirrors could like come closer to one another and further away too. That was another aspect of this whole aligning thing. The thing that I'm wondering about, I couldn't find. Let me drop it. WS2N. They're doing it now inside this whole room, massive room. It all looks like it's about 40 feet in diameter. It's a big round door that they open up. And they're testing everything, making sure everything works in this cold environment. What about when they get out to space after this rough rocket ride and the thing is 1 million miles all the way out? Are they sending this laser beam set up? Is that going to be part of the spacecraft? After it's out there, they're going to have to realign everything and make sure everything works. Good news is probably once it's set, once they have it set, there's no gravity and the heat won't change much because it's going to be in the shade constantly. They'll probably never have to turn this laser beam on if they're bringing one with them or the motors ever again. Back to you, Dick.
Now, Paul, I'm convinced that the laser interferometer is a built-in test equipment. I don't think that was ground-based test equipment just for this test being done in the vacuum cryogenic chamber in Houston. Now, I think that laser beam tester is built-in testing, and when it gets out to Lagrange point number two, it's going to be turned on again to test all the mirrors. Has to be. I didn't know that they have motors that will move them sideways so you can get rid of the crack between the 18 panels. And it does make some sense because those cracks between the panels will give you a predictable kind of a side lobe in the picture you get out of the telescope if those cracks are too wide. So I think you're saying that the beryllium panels can be moved closer to each other to make the cracks almost disappear, as well as adjusting the shapes. Nicely done. And you've got to do that because after the shake, rattle, and roll of launch, and then deployment, guarantee in space at Lagrange point number two, X number of months downrange after that launch, those motors are going to have to be adjusted. And the one thing I worry about is, do each of those motors have enough dynamic range to line everything up? Over to you, Paul. That's one hell of an instrument. Boy, there's an awful lot of details that have got to work just right. Seven motors per mirror, 18 mirrored segments, a whole bunch of motors on the subreflector, primary, secondary subreflector. There's motors all over the place on this thing. The motors that do the deployment.
Repeater, timeout.
There are motors that pull out those six Mylar sun shields, properly tighten them. There are motors that operate the shafts that have the pulleys that do all that work. Considering how complicated this thing is, I think you said the The current price is running something like $8 billion, Paul. WS2N, KQIW.
I've seen different numbers, but the latest one I saw was $8.8 billion. I think that was on an NASA site, so I'm going to go with that one. I have seen $10 billion. So who knows? The motors that bring the mirrors closer to one another, I thought they would need something like that. Don't forget, this thing is folded up, you know, not only the sunshade and everything that else, you know, that has to open up before they start doing anything. This whole mirror is lapsed inside the bearing of the Ariane 5 rocket. You know, the mirrors themselves actually open up. So, you know, there has to be some kind of an initial space between them, you know, to have that function, to be able to. By the way, each mirror is a hexagonal shape. Now, they've had experience with this type of mirrors before. Well, not the exact same mirrors, but this kind of design. I remember years ago, they were trying to figure out if the Keck telescope was going to work. That's one in Hawaii or Arizona, I forget. But the Keck telescope has this mirror shape. Each mirror is a hexagonal shape, and each one of those have motors, and everything is moved that way. Let me drop the ground-based mirror that's so big that if they were to make it out of one big mirror, it wouldn't work because the gravity itself would change the shape of a big round mirror, not to mention how heavy it would be. So this is very lightweight compared to a conventional design, and it all works good. There's plenty of discoveries that are coming back from Keck, and I believe there's quite a few other mirrors that telescopes that have been designed like this, and there's a lot more on the drawing board. Good design, and I wonder about these motors. I mean, you know, to have that kind of accuracy, they go down to 1/10,000th of the distance of a human hair. I mean, each motor must be have a little transmission gear that, you know, a gearing that goes down to it. You know, I can't imagine the gears inside this thing. I wonder if they're all made of plastic. Plastic gears, or they're going to use steel or, you know, real gears, metal gears for this almost $10 billion telescope. What do you think, Dave?
Now, slowly calculating. What's your guess, Paul? Is human hair about 1/1000th of an inch in diameter?
Yeah, they talked about how many atoms. Oh, I forgot. I don't remember. I have to go back to the article. How many atoms thick distance would be that they're going to cover? You know, they're getting down to the atoms. So no, I don't know offhand. Back.
I'm going to guess the human hair is close to 1/1000th of an inch, maybe a little bit less. So 1/10,000th of the thickness of a human hair is 4 × 10⁻⁷ inches. I'm going to convert that into meters. Right now, the anticipated launch time for James Webb Space Telescope Infrared, I think you said it's around October of 2018. And the nice thing about that is it doesn't have to meet up with some other planet. It doesn't have to intercept a Jupiter for a flyby or whatever. So if they're late a week, a month, or a year, it doesn't matter as long as they launch when they're really ready, when the weather's good. So is the current launch date October 2018 of you, Paul?
Yeah, it's supposed to be September, but it might, last time I read it might shift to October. They have the Colombo BEPI launch. That's also supposed to be launched around that time. And that's going to be an orbiter that goes around Mercury eventually. So they, you know, that's going to take priority because that does have a certain launch window that they have to abide by to do all their planet gravitational assist. So they, you know, that's that one time. And they could actually push James Webb, you know, from September to October, or even into spring of next year, they said it would be a possibility. of the following year, 2019. But right now, Led by her was still October of next year. So that will be good. The Colombo, mission takes priority. We're also being launched out of Kourou, French Guiana, in South America, by the European Space Agency on another Ariane 5 rocket. Back to you.
Yeah, if a human hair is a thousandth of an inch, then 1/10,000th of that is 2.54 nanometers. If a human hair is less than a thousandth of an inch, it might be a 10,000th, it might be, 10,000th of an inch, then it would be 0.2 nanometers. So somewhere between 0.2 and 2 nanometers is the accuracy they're looking for. The wavelength they're going to be looking at is over 1,000 nanometers. So their accuracy is going to be approximately 1,000th of a wavelength. A diffraction-limited telescope, they usually consider it a diffraction-limited telescope if the mirror is accurate to the nearest 20th of a wavelength. So these guys are way beyond that. So as I see it, they're going to get an awful clear picture out of this one, as long as the rest of the detector works well. I think the detector is a focal plane array with lots of megapixels. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW?
Yeah, I think it was 7. So not that much. 7 megapixels, that sounds low. I think Hubble was, that was 5 megapixels, and then James Webb was 7.5 or something. I'd have to, I really don't remember. Oh, by the way, the Keck Observatory was the one in Hawaii, and that's got all those hexagonal shapes. So, the detector has to go down to, I know what I'm thinking about, not 7.5, I'm thinking 7.5 Kelvin. That's what the temperature's going to go down to on the detector. I don't know how many megapixels this thing's going to have. Primarily visual and also infrared, mainly infrared is what they want to look at, because that could look beyond the dust of a planet or a galaxy. It looks right through the dust without seeing it whatsoever. Let me drop it. When Hubble was upgraded in 2009, they put a better infrared system on that, covering wavelengths that they never covered before on Hubble, and they show pictures of before and after with Hubble, and it's remarkable when they show, you know, what they're looking at, you know, Crab Nebula or something like that. It looks right through it, and that's what this thing is going to do. It's going to probably be able to tell you if these exoplanets that they're looking at, which, what, over 3,000 are now confirmed. It's going to be able to look at some of those and tell you what the atmosphere is made out of. They're actually getting close without James Webb. But James Webb will clear up any debate. Back to you.
I just looked up the thickness of a human hair on Google. And there are some very fine human hairs and very thick ones. So human hairs range between 17... and 180 micrometers. 17 to 180. And I'm going to guess that that's in the vicinity of 1,000th of an inch. I'll work that one out. So, you probably already said it, and I may have missed it, Paul. When's the next launch that we might be able to see, either by going to a NASA site or maybe even looking outside at the right time? When's the next launch? Before we go to that, this is a Chinese equivalent of a Progress ship that docked and undocked so many times, the cargo ship. I am guessing the way you described it, that was all done by remote control from the ground, or were the human beings on board the Chinese space station that was controlling all of those maneuvers? WS2N, KQLIW.
By the way, if anybody wants a schedule on future launches worldwide, you know, it's not just NASA. spaceflightnow.com. It's very good. I use that all the time. And there's a couple more, but that one's very good. Yeah, and it wasn't.